Brown Money. Setting: standing in a field of tobacco, one man and his son are examining a tobacco plant. The man is talking to his son, pointing toward the plant. Their modest farmhouse can be seen in the background. The midday sun radiates heat, bearing down on Edward Mitchell, a middling Eastern Carolina farmer, as he converses with his young son, Benjamin. The sweat that drains down his ruddy cheeks is rarely problematic. He dutifully carries a small rag that he uses to wipe his brow, seemingly endlessly. He stands before his son, explaining the importance of tobacco on his small farm and its use in colonial society. Edward explains to Ben that he is old enough to learn these lessons well. He must listen carefully, being told only once, and understanding well enough to act accordingly thereafter. After explaining what he must be done, Ben must work in the field. He must help on the family farm. He must do his part to bring in brown money for the family. William patiently explains why with a story of his own. "Not so very long ago," he begins, "this land was wilderness, devoid of civilization and inhabited only by savages. Edward's father, William, immigrated to the shores of Virginia in the year 1699 as an indentured servant. Like most indentured servants, his contract lasted for 7 long years. 7 years of brutal labor in sweltering fields of tobacco. During his extensive labors, William learned the tricks of tobacco cultivation, a style of farming different from that of his native England. Although it was demanding, he gratefully learned all he could. The gentleman farmer, a Mr. Rolf Erickson, Esquire, paid for his passage to the New World. He was strict, but patient to a degree. He expected everyone to work as hard as he did. That meant getting up before daybreak to be ready in the fields at the first light of dawn. Mr. Erickson expected everyone to be able to understand how to do a job after being told only once. If a second explanation was required, a reduction in food rations that day or extra chores after dark were expected. William learned quickly to listen well. He learned to carefully nurture the nearly invisible tobacco seed. He would later tell his own family that he was amazed at how something so tiny could grow into something so big. The infant plants had to be shaded from the harsh Carolina sun. William felt his own skin burn under the intense heat after hours and hours outside, so he could understand what that indomitable force could do to a delicate, supple leaf. The seedling had to be carefully transplanted to allow for plenty of room for growth, both of the roots and the leaves. This was a tricky job that, if not done properly, could kill the plants without the proper amount of water. William related that he had learned that the hard way, but not more than once. As the plant grew sturdier, care was given to keep weeds pulled and worms off the adolescent plant, another toilsome task under the heat of summer sun. This job seemed eternal. It didn't help that the days were at their lengthiest. When cooler weather commenced, so did harvesting and curing of the adult plant. It was back-breaking work to slice the stalks, carefully stack them for transport to the tobacco barns, and then hang the leaves to cure. He told in later years that the sleepless nights as his shoulder and neck muscles ached from the work. Finally came the day of packing and shipping the dried tobacco to market along the great rivers of the Chesapeake. During that time, he found a few spare moments to search out possible property he hoped to buy when his indenture was complete. He searched among the rivers, but to no avail, as the colony was fast becoming occupied by great waves of immigrants arriving each day. The rich, wealthy, and established landowners took up the lands by the rivers. The easy access for trading and the rich soil made the river bottoms the most desirable, so, of course, they were settled first. William discovered that many men were like him, bound by indentures, but hopeful to gain their freedom and search for land that wasn't too far removed from the precious river routes that made trade possible. In 1706, the long-awaited day came when he was released from his indenture, and William immediately headed southward toward the great swamps of southeastern Virginia and the waters of the Albemarle. Here, in the great land grants of the Carolina proprietors, William carved out 50 acres from among the low, swampy lands. He planted wheats, potatoes, peas, corns, beans, and pumpkins for food crops. For cash, tobacco was his mainstay. And that, explained Edward, was how they came to be here, where they are today. William had worked hard to start this farm and made it prosperous. He had shared his knowledge of farming and trading with his son Edward, and now Edward was beginning to do the same with his own son, Ben. "It is who we are," explained Edward, "farmers who earn an honest living with our hands." Edward explained to his son that tobacco was still worth money to the colonial proprietors. He used it to pay a quit rent annually, for he does not own the land, which he has cleared as he expands from the acreage that his father has left to him. Also, taxes are paid in pounds of tobacco. Tobacco was necessary each year, if only a small amount, to pay the rents and taxes. Working hard means a good tobacco crop. Tobacco means money, and money means a comfortable life and a better future. Edward warns his son to be diligent, as the brown weed is easily destroyed. He points to the great veins on the underside of the leaves as the gathering points for the worms that suck the life from the plant. He must pluck these worms daily and smash them between his fingers, as smashing them with his feet might not rid the plant of the pest. Often the same worm will return when thrown on the ground, thus destroying an entire crop within the week. William also alerts his son to the dangers of poor soil, as tobacco must be planted in a different field each year. Finally, he describes the careful curing of tobacco as a very labor-intensive task requiring constant attention. But those lessons will come soon enough. Now it is time for Ben to get to work, worming the plants in this field closest to home. Examining the plant, Edward is hopeful that this year's crop will be plentiful. He will begin the harvest in a month. In the meantime, he will prepare the hogsheads that will be used for packing the tobacco and rolling them down the path to the Nansemond River. The trek will be arduous, but not difficult, and the rewards are expected to be great this year. Next year, he plans to expand his harvest westward, on new lands he has worked hard to clear for his brown money. Historical notes and teaching tips. The perception of the great plantations of colonial Virginia, such as Berkeley, Shirley, Westover, and Carter's Grove, along the James River, leaves an indelible mark on the minds of people, of vast fields worked by hordes of black slaves, toiling in the heat and humidity of the summer sun. But the reality is far different. Most immigrants before Bacon's Rebellion in 1676, including many Africans, arrived as indentured servants in colonial Virginia. After their indentures were satisfied, these immigrants began their lives with little except the few skills learned during their service. Many migrated westward and others southward toward less desirable but vacant lands. Inspired by a visit to Colonial Williamsburg's Great Hope Plantation, a small operating colonial farm exhibit, Brown Money blends the story of indentured servitude, tobacco cultivation as a cash crop, and the struggles of a small eastern North Carolina farmer to show an unromanticized view of small farmers at the turn of the 17th century that relied on a small tobacco cash crop for cash. Through an oral story format and family history passed down through the generations, the struggle of one average family comes to life. An interesting sideline to this story is that many along the dividing line between Virginia and present-day North Carolina often tried to claim residency in the opposite colony when the tax collector was present. William Byrd's survey attempted to settle the dispute of the dividing line, but many continued to pursue an isolated life, scratching out an existence in the remote wilds of the Great Dismal Swamp.